I've been sort of thinking about this talk for a little while now, and certainly this week I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be talking about the Buddha, and something about that which touched my heart again. So I'm pleased to have this opportunity to talk about somebody who lived 2,500 years ago in northern India. Yeah, so in a way he's kind of quite a remote figure from me, from us in some ways, but he was a human being, a man who lived a long time ago in northern India. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, and he was part of a tribe of people called the Shakyans. His father was, well, it's the nomenclature doesn't really carry across, but he was a chieftain or a king, like a senior figure in this people. And when Siddhartha was born, it was said that he was destined to either become a great sort of political leader of his people or a great sage. So right from the early days, it was sort of his card was marked as for greatness. But it certainly wasn't clear which way he would go, whether it would be maybe sort of more political and warfaring, or whether it would be more in terms of a spiritual vocation. His father was certainly keen for him to go in the direction more of the political warfaring side of things, you know, to take over his leadership role within the tribe, the people, and to take that on. It seems as though he had quite, once again, like from the text, you have to sort of like feel your way into a bit, but it seems as though he had kind of quite a privileged upbringing in some ways. So a few things about that. His father was from the warrior caste, so there's in India at that time, and still there's echoes of it today. In India at that time, the caste system was very strong, and there was the Brahmin caste and the warrior caste. So the warrior caste was a high caste position. But that means that he would also have been trained up as a youth and a young man in terms of like how to handle himself in terms of war and combat. So he would have had that kind of training. Also, it seems as though he had a very kind of quite an opulent place. It seems as though he had different palaces for different seasons. Yeah? So in India, there's kind of the rainy season, which is there's lots and lots of rain, and you can design a building to set that up to be as most comfortable as possible for that season. But it's also very, very hot in India as well. So he had another palace where he would go for the sunny season. And I think there was from what we can make out, there would have been quite a lot. Like maybe for us, a good parallel would be the kind of royalty. Do you know what I mean? So a court, and there would have been entertainment and good food and all of that kind of thing. And I think he was really kind of looked after by his father and protected by his father. It seems as though this prediction of whether he became a warrior or a great sage, his father was quite keen to like try and steer him, not probably as uncommon from fathers today, like wanting their sons or daughters to be moving to particular professions. So it's said that he tried to sort of shield him from life in some ways, and sort of not bring him into contact with religious people, and also protect him from some of the truths about life as well. It seems as though he got married. There's some dispute about that, but generally speaking, it seems as though he got married and he had a son. And in some ways, he had a lot going for him. He was going to be taking over from his father. He seems as though he was very capable. There's sort of stories of him winning competitions in terms of warrior skills and that kind of thing. So it seems as though he was very capable, very privileged upbringing, and also just enjoying the pleasures of kind of quite a courtly life. But there was also something about Siddhartha where he was like questioning. He had a questioning aspect to him. And is this, there was a kind of a sense, it seems, that, well, is this all that life is about? There's all of these good things and good people around me, but is this it? And the story goes that he wanted to sort of like go out into the villages and like find out a bit more about life. And it's said that he has four sites. He has like four visits, four goings out, and he has sees four different sites. So I think it's been sort of like conceptualized and like standardized in order to pass down over 2,500 years. But I think we can think about these sites as like the Buddha seeing more deeply into the truth of human existence. So the first site was it's said that he goes out in a chariot and goes out into the town, and he sees somebody who is sick, maybe being carried on a stretcher or something like that. And he asks his companion, who is that? It's as though he's never seen a sick person before. And it really goes in, very, very deeply. Oh, there's a sick person. And through his conversation with his companion, he realises that all human beings are open to being sick at some point. So that was the first sight, seeing a sick person. The second sight was seeing somebody who was elderly. So somebody seeing who's like, you know, like stooped over and maybe finding it difficult to walk, and you know, just really not in the best of the health. So he's in his prime, but he sees somebody who's elderly. And once again, so we probably have these sights. We see elderly people, we see sick people. But in some ways, it's hard to take on board, certainly as a young person, that will happen to us. That is part of being human. But it seems for Siddhartha, he really saw it. He said, just as this person is getting old, I'm going to get old one day. And then he saw a dead person. He saw somebody being, maybe there was a kind of some sort of funeral service, and the reality of death struck home as well. So those were the three sights, the first three sights, and they sort of like deeply shocked him. And I think, it sort of can feel familiar to us, but I think there's a depth of seeing that Siddhartha saw, which is probably a bit deeper than we generally see, I would say. But then he saw a fourth sight, and in India at the time there was a kind of a sort of a tradition of going forth from the family life, from the household life, in search of truth. And the fourth sight is he saw a holy man who was just walking through perhaps the village in a very composed, dignified way, just wearing rags, just wearing old clothes, so very simply dressed. But there was something about the dignity of his bearing and perhaps his purposefulness. And perhaps, and then through once again in conversation with his companion, he thought, okay, well, maybe this is a way out of the human condition. Maybe if I can sort of discover truth, the rules of old age, sickness and death won't apply to me. So the Buddha decides to go forth. Siddhartha decides to go forth. He dramatically like goes off in the middle of the night, leaves his wife, his child, his father, his family, the whole court situation, and resolutely, determinedly decides to go forth in quest of truth. And this was a tradition that happened in India at the time. It says that he cut off his long hair, he gave his jewellery and his fine robes to his companion, and he just went on, he got rag robes, and he went off into the forest, you could say. So he did. So that was at the age of 29, and then for the next 6 years, up until he was 35, he was really trying to understand the nature of reality, really understand that for himself. And he did all sorts of things in order to try and do that. So the first thing he did was he tried to get some good teachers to help him discover. And so, as I said, there was a spiritual tradition of this at the time. And so he got into contact with a couple of people who were well known, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, two well-respected teachers. And basically he went and spent time with them. It's said that he learned everything that they knew very quickly. They offered to share the leadership of their gang, if you like. He refused, thinking that there was more teaching still to discover, and went off by himself. Then he, there's accounts of him going into the forest and experiencing great fear, and realising that some of this fear was just irrational, you know, that he'd had a very causative, privileged upbringing. And just like animals in the forest just making the branches move at night time would send this like terrible fear through him. And he decided to just sort of stay with the fear and allow it to pass. And there's also talk of him doing ascetic practices. So he fasted and he did really extreme fasting, actually, so he became very, very emaciated. He was convinced that this was the way to truth, through fasting. And that was a kind of a philosophy that existed at the time. But then he had this memory, just as when he was very, very weak, he had this memory of himself underneath the rose apple tree when he was a child. And it's just this memory from childhood. So now he's maybe, 34, and he has this memory for when he was about 12, 13, 14, something like that. And he was at a ploughing match with his father, and it was a beautiful day, and he was watching the... He'd gone off on his own and was just sitting underneath the shade of a tree, and he just got into this very absorbed, pleasurable, blissful, meditative state, quite spontaneously. And he sort of thought that that experience was a key to understanding the truth of the nature of reality. So after that, he started taking food again, and he sort of redressed how he'd been practicing. So he started practicing in a more balanced way, taking food, but also still making an incredible effort to break through in terms of meditation. And then it's said that he did manage to break through. He got to the point where he just decided that he would, after he'd got his strength back, he would just sit underneath this Bodhi tree, and he would just sit there until he understood. So thankfully he was he knew that he was pretty close. So over the course of like a whole sort of night and day, it seems as though he went into this kind of very, very rich internal experience, which then exploded into just another dimension. And that's the experience that we Buddhists talk about as the enlightenment experience, which is an internal experience of universal loving kindness, great compassion. But it's also deeply mysterious. So it's said in the Buddhist tradition that you can't actually put it into words. Words can't really describe it. The only way to get a sense of it is to experience it for yourself. And the Buddha tried, all of his teachings and practices are a way to try and help other people to have that experience for themselves. And those teachings and practices have been handed down to us over the centuries, over the last 2,500 years. So the Buddha gained enlightenment at the age of 35, and he carried on teaching for the rest of his life. So for him, the most important thing that he could do in the world was to help people to overcome suffering, to open up to them a path to liberation. True and deep liberation. And he developed with his disciples a whole range of practices and teachings in order to be able to do that. And learned through teaching, so learned through actually applying the principles, what worked, what didn't work, learned how to communicate with people. So there's lots I could say about that, but I'm just going to like briefly mention the five precepts as a way of talking about these things. Well, actually, no, I won't do that. I'll go this other way. So that's the basic life story. So he has this experience, and then he spends the rest of his life teaching about this experience. And so I suppose, is the Buddha's teaching relevant for us today? Is this guy who lived 500 years ago, has he got relevant things to say for us now? So I think he has. Yeah? And you may have questions and you may disagree with me, but I think he has. I think Buddhism is a universal religion because it relates to the individual needs of the human being, yeah? Of the individual. We're in an existential situation. In a way, we've been thrown up onto the earth at this particular time and place. In a way, we don't really know why. And we're trying to sort of make sense of our experience. There's sort of different worldviews. There's a kind of eternalistic worldview with a creator God. That's kind of one whole way of understanding how and why we're here. And there's also a kind of another view which is kind of more nihilistic, which it's kind of, well, just mysterious and chaotic, and there's no order to it. Yeah? So Buddhism is saying something different from that. There's also life here in England in the modern West is much more complex than it was in the Buddha's day. So there's, central government, there's big business, there's the charity sector. There's all sorts of things, lots and lots of people living together, all sorts of different views and beliefs and things. Life is very, very different. There's people who aspire to the American dream, finding happiness in that way. There's people who are more concerned with bringing about social justice. There's all sorts of ways in which people express what's important to them in their lives. But I think the Four Noble Truths are really sort of go to the heart of the matter in terms of our existential situation. And I think it's something that we can reflect on and relate to. But the four sights actually is good news. So even though there is old age, sickness and death, which I think is hard to deny, there is this fourth sight. And this fourth sight is this potential for human development, potential for human growth. And the Buddha sort of lays out a whole set of practices which can help that. But there are other practices from other traditions which are also relate to growth and helping other people grow. Our actions have consequences. We can have an effect in the world. We can have an effect on our own life, and we can also influence our social circle and influence the local community, and also we can in a democracy you can also play a part in influencing what's going on nationally too. So I think this foresight is both sort of it's good news. There's a sort of a sense of possibility with it, but it's also like quite challenging. It does sort of throw the ball back into our court. It's up to us what we do with that information and how we act. For Buddhism, it sort of really stems from the mind. So the more that we can, in a way, sort of shape and influence what goes on in our mind, the more we'll be able to live happier lives. So the more we can dwell upon thoughts of generosity, love, wisdom, develop those qualities within our mind, the more we'll be happy. Yeah? The more we sort of dwell upon and the qualities of meanness, delusion, hate are in our mind, the harder that will be, yeah, to move into a happier realm. So I think like fundamental to Buddhism is this a principle of like non-violence, a principle of non-violence or loving kindness. It's in a way it's a really old teaching, yeah, and Yeah, it's sort of it's so old. You can sort of, well, I can sort of know that it's good not to be violent. I think everybody can sort of relate to that. But I think there's all sorts of ways in which we can sort of apply it more deeply, and take the understanding of it more deeply. So we can practice generosity, trying to be more loving, more kind, more aware of other people. We can sort of become aware of our resistance and when we've perhaps given as much as we feel as though we can give, and sometimes just be able to overcome that resistance and do the little bit extra. If we can do that, it can feel like a good thing in the moment, and also it's creating a kind of a more generous, loving person as well for the future. So I think we can do that in an individual way. I think we do need to learn to get to know ourselves and balance and pace ourselves and not set off too quickly, but also, you know, make sure that we do make enough effort. And that can take time to, you know, work out how to work with ourselves. And we can also have an effect in the collective. So there's a story from the Buddha's tradition around there was a conflict. I think it was about there was a kind of a lake or water source, and there was two peoples living around this water source, and they were basically they were sort of in competition for how it was being used, and they got into disagreement, and you know how these things can like build up, and like before long they were getting more and more polarized, and it was going from irritation to anger to real anger to hatred to it looks as though these two like tribes were going to like go to war with one another. And the Buddha went and heard about this conflict that was arising, and he went and engaged with the people there, and he went and spoke to one side and spent time with them and tried to understand their situation. He went to the other side and tried to understand their situation, really, really listened to them, and then went back and spoke to them again. And I think what he did is he really tried to get them to get to the point where they realised that well, actually, human beings, people, are more important than water. So human beings are more important than water. So it, in a way, it would be rather ironic to go to war over this water source. Yeah? But that was what was threatening. So they tried to, he got to them to the point where they agreed that, that the people were more important. And then from there, they could work out how to share, you know, the water resource. So it was sort of like, in a way, he was willing to sort of engage in a non-violent way and to try and understand people, like take into account what the situation was, and then try and find a creative solution. And so that's just like one story from the Buddhist tradition. So I've spoken for 20 minutes. I've just been strict with myself. I've got other things I could say, but I just want to sort of open it up now, just in case anything's like triggered any questions for you. Yeah.
The fourth sight that the Buddha saw of the happy, holy man.
Yeah.
Doesn't that point to the fact that the solution for suffering and death is actually to be found in God?
Well, I suppose for you know, a Christian or somebody from that tradition could sort of read it in that kind of way. I suppose I'm speaking from the Buddhist tradition, and practicing a spiritual life can sort of like come in all sorts of manifestations. So I suppose what I'm interested in doing is presenting the Buddhist take on it. So the, you know, for a Buddhist, it would be about you know, trying to follow the teachings of the Buddha. That's what's going to lead to liberation. But yeah, I suppose for other people it could mean to lead to other courses of life. And I think, I mean, there is it in terms of like the sight, but sometimes people have experiences, don't they? People have religious experiences, and I think it can depend on which context that you're in. So in Britain we've had a context which has been predominantly Christian, and people have understood their religious experiences within that context, and for many of them that has led them to turning to God. Yeah? Speaking personally, I travelled in Thailand and had a moment, a religious moment there, and I was in a Buddhist context, and that sort of seemed to be significant for me in terms of like following the Buddhist path. But, yeah, so that's how I'd respond to that question.
Yeah. What's very intriguing is his time under the tree to be enlightened, you know, to find the push,
yeah,
to break through.
Yeah.
And reach that level of depth of consciousness.
Yep.
So I was wondering if you could talk about that final push a bit more. What's more color? What were the dynamics?
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a very personal experience.
Yep.
And we can't do any justice to it. But
yeah. No, I can say more. I can say more. Yeah. So there's sort of like stories or sort of myths around that final breakthrough, and it's sort of like spoken of in terms of like Mara. So Mara is all the forces sort of inside Siddhartha Gautama in the world that doesn't want the Buddha to gain enlightenment, doesn't want to break through to this final attainment. So it's said that, and so you can understand this both, you can sort of understand it both in terms of story, in terms of psychology. That's probably the easiest way for us to understand it today. But it's said that that Mara sort of came to the Buddha underneath the tree, and he sent his daughters to him. So he sent his very, very beautiful daughters to try and lure him off the path with sexual attraction. So so if we can imagine all of our kind of our impulses towards sensuality, he was using all of that to try to distract him from meditating and to making this final push through. So then that didn't work. The Buddha just like carried on with his meditation, carried on trying to move into deeper states of consciousness. Then the Buddha, it said that all of the violent forces, so you can think, so it said that Mara, Mara is sort of like like the devil figure in Buddhism, but he's not quite as malevolent, he's more mischievous, yeah? But he doesn't want the Buddha to gain enlightenment, so he sends all of his warriors, so all of the kind of destructive forces to try and prevent the Buddha from gaining enlightenment. And it's said that, you know, they come and attack him. So you can imagine him sort of psychologically, all of the forces in him that don't want him to gain enlightenment sort of psychologically attack him as he's trying to move through these higher states of consciousness. But once again, he manages to fend them off, and these arrows and things that are fired at him, they turn into flowers. So his sort of momentum is so strong. His ability to sort of keep moving through the higher stages of consciousness so developed that he manages to beat back the attack. And then finally, Mara comes to him and says, "Who are you to be sitting on the seat of enlightenment? What makes you so special that you think you can gain enlightenment?" And it's said that the Buddha touches the earth, and the earth goddess comes up from the earth. And she, in a way, symbolises bearing witness to all of the ethical actions that the Buddha has made over lifetimes. So once again, Buddhism has this kind of bigger perspective. It isn't just this life. Actually, he's been practising for many lives, and then in this life, and all of the fruits of that ethical action have meant that he is the person right now who can break through into enlightenment. So you can think about that final stage as overcoming the forces of sensuality, yeah? Overcoming the forces of hatred, and overcoming the forces of doubt in order to break through into enlightenment. Just in relationship to sensuality, I mean, the Buddha definitely thought that that pleasure was a good and necessary thing, and there were certain like wholesome, harmful pleasures that one needed in order to keep making progress. So I think it's pretty good to underline that as well. Anyone else?
But did the Buddha offer any solution to the problem of death?
That's another good question. The Buddhist tradition says that the Noble Eightfold Path is the path to the deathless. Yeah? Is the path to the deathless. That's the one way in which it's talked about. So this can be a bit hard to describe, and this is where words sort of seem to fail us. So I think it's quite helpful to be able to relate to the Buddha in terms of him being a human being who lived and walked the earth. But when he moved into the experience of enlightenment, he transcended. He became, in a way, you could say, a completely different thing, a new order of consciousness. And in a way, the laws of life and death didn't apply to him in quite the same way. So although his body did eventually stop functioning, so we would be able to sort of see and understand that his body stopped, and it sort of looks as though it happens in the normal way. From the Buddhist point of view, what happens to his conscious is much more mysterious than that. Yeah? And that mysterious consciousness is being carried around while he's alive within the body. And as it were, it's sort of released after death. Words fail. But that's the Buddhist take on it. And the Buddha is saying that that we can all gain enlightenment, and his teachings is the path to the immortal in that sense. You can talk about it in that, or really, really waking up to life would be another way of putting it, and living more deeply and more fully.
There's no concept of afterlife.
What we usually talk about it in terms of rebirth. Yeah? So with the Buddha, the Buddha's sort of, if you're enlightened, that's a kind of a bit of an exceptional case, which is hard to categorise. For most of us, what happens is that the Buddhist perspective would say that the laws of karma, so that actions have consequences. That there is continuance. Yeah, so. How we live in this life will affect what happens in the next life. We don't talk about it in terms of reincarnation, so it's not as though like a sort of a fixed independent soul gets transplanted into a new being in the next life. It's more mysterious than that. It's more that there's nothing fixed within us, but something of our volitions, karmic volitions, like gets carried through. So it's like a bit like a metaphor which is often used is like one fire torch lighting another fire torch. And so the flame continues, but the flames are actually different and moving. Do you see what I mean? And so it's said that that's what happens with human consciousness. And then with enlightenment, there's a whole other level of mystery further than that. So, it's said that, in the modern West, we can often be quite sceptical about that. But you don't need to believe that in order to get on with the meditation practices and get on with some very basic teachings which are helpful. When I started 20 years ago, I was quite sceptical about rebirth. And I'm sort of more open to it now. But the truth of the matter is I don't know. That's the truth of the matter. But there's more openness, and I think that for me as a Buddhist practitioner, that's a good thing. Yeah.
I don't know whether it could be covered in something else later on today, but sort of to come back to the reincarnation or the rebirth death business, is this separation between the body, the mind, the whatever, all these different things you want to call it, which I find quite offensive. completely understand is, okay, there's a physical bit, then I've probably not got the correct terminology, but say mind, spirit, brain, heart, whatever,
yeah,
is quite interesting, perhaps explains it a bit, but I'm not entirely clear. So, can you clarify it, or is it going to be talked about in another session today, do you think?
Okay, can you just draw out the question a bit more for me?
It's explaining a bit more about the difference between, say, the physical body that you inhabit, then the mind, stroke, spirit, whatever you want to call it, but the actual experiencing of what the physical body experiences.
Right.
Okay. The difference between, I suppose, the spiritual and the body and something else.
Okay, so I can speak to that, yeah. So one way of talking about this is only one way, but one way of talking about it. I mean, so when I got ordained, I was given a different practice, which is called the six element practice. And in that practice, what you do is you sort of analyse yourself and the world in relationship to the six elements. Yeah? So the elements are earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. Yeah? And so from a Buddhist perspective, everything is made up of those six elements. Yeah? So as a Buddhist practitioner, what you try and do is you try and see that there's a flow between those elements. Yeah? That flow is going on now all of the time. So at the moment we're sitting out in this room and there's air in the room, but we're also breathing in air into us. So there's air in us and there's air outside us, and that flow is going on. Yeah? And it's about, the more deeply that you can see that there's sort of nothing sort of fixed and separate about us, in a way, the closer to reality you become. So it's a practice to help you try and see that you're not fixed and separate in the way in which we generally think we are. We probably often have a really sort of strong sense of I, and then there's a sort of strong sense of other. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's not like that. It's more mysterious than that. Does that help? It's an angle on it. Maybe I can talk to you a bit more afterwards as well. Any others? Yeah.
Okay. I don't quite understand the full concept of non-violence.
Okay.
I understand it in a way that you wouldn't go out of your way to be violent, but
yeah.
I don't understand what you expect to do if you become the
Okay. Well, the Buddhist tradition can be. There's all sorts of teachings on this. I'll start with the most, the hardest and the most demanding. I mean, there is one teaching that, if somebody comes and hits you, I mean, you put your body there, and you need to sort of deal with that. Yeah, and not react with violence, even though you've been attacked. Yeah. So that's like kind of one really, really sort of... He's adamant, this in principle of like non-violence is really, really, really important. So in a way, no matter how violent somebody is towards you, you don't react and retaliate with violence. So that's one thing I can say. I think you can also think about it in terms of like just trying to do the most good and the least harm. Yeah, let's get that one right. I don't want you leaving with that in your mind. So the most good and the least harm. Yeah? And of course, in everyday life, that's not easy to know how to do. So you need to be aware of yourself, you need to be aware of the other person, you need to be aware of the situation. You need to... and then try and come up with the most creative response. We sometimes talk about if you do have to use power, if you do have to use force, then that being governed by the love mode. So, for example, if a young child comes and puts her hand in a candle, you probably would decide to take her hand out. You know, you might force her hand out in order to protect her. But the underlying thing there would be for her not to harm herself. So that's ideally what you're trying to do, to sort of just staying in the love mode as much as you can. And then I think also, but it doesn't mean, it means sort of being robust and engaging with people. Somebody's just being, you know, really rude to you and unpleasant to you, you might have to just sort of, you know, face their energy and you know, meet that, you know. And sometimes actually that doesn't need to lead to violence. It can just be a good, healthy meeting their energy. You know, so sometimes that can be possible. There's all sorts of different scenarios, you know, that one can sort of imagine. But the principle is like non-violence, loving kindness. You know, trying to come up with a creative solution, a creative response, and not a reactive response. It's so easy if somebody criticises us or does us down to want to retaliate in some way, even if it's just an impulse in the mind. And of course there's been all sorts of conditions in society where revenge does get wrought in horrendous ways. The 20th century was, you know, a nightmare in that respect, wasn't it, with the two world wars. And I think while we do have those traces of irritation in our mind, that can escalate. So in the moment we're in quite a tolerant society, not perfect but quite tolerant. If society changes, those forces within us can sort of come out and be played out in all sorts of different ways. So I think it's sort of an important thing to actually, while the conditions are good, to in a way to build the peace, you know, to create harmony, to try and live harmoniously with one another, to build a better society. And just like little acts can have a real effect on that.
This is all good stuff, and I hesitate to mention it, but what about Sri Lanka? What's been going on there?
So, I mean, I don't really understand the situation in Sri Lanka myself. I've not been there, and I'm not very up to date on it. I know one of my fellow practitioners who's very experienced, I think, and knows the political climate over there. I mean, I think there you've got a different situation where there's people who've grown up with Buddhism, and like Buddhism does seem to be being used to keep things in order and partly used to legitimise violence, I think, in some situations as well. So I don't know very much about it, but I've heard somebody was, you know, using the language of racism in relationship to some of the activities of Buddhists in Sri Lanka. So I suppose there's also, I mean, I don't think it's wherever you go, there can be people practicing more or less sincerely. Yeah? And I'm sure there are people, sincere Buddhists doing their thing there, but I think there's also other things going on. And I think it's very tied in to, you know, the state as well, in a way in which certainly at the moment Buddhism isn't here. You know, there's a kind of a secular state, and all sorts of people from different religions are allowed to practice their own religion in their own way, but they're not allowed to control things in the way in which it seems as though Buddhism has more influence in Sri Lanka. But as I say, I'm very ignorant about it.
Do you think there's a racist element?
Well, I know one of my colleagues has used that. I was quite shocked that he used that term. So that was certainly his take on it, and I do respect his judgment. But I'd need to sort of look into it a lot more.
Is he Tamil or Sinhalese?
No, he's a Western Buddhist.
Western.
So one more, perhaps.
After Buddha's enlightenment, what actions and what steps did he take to spread his teaching? I'm sure his motive, his first motive is not to spread it, but to implement it as much as he can in his life and his others. So what kind of life did he lead after his enlightenment?
So I mean, the first thing to say is that he wasn't sure. He has this like tremendous experience. He sort of, and it's sometimes hard to discern what is fact and what's myth. But it sort of said he sort of didn't, you know, he was there for like 24 hours and then has this experience, and then like for 7 days he doesn't move, and he just like looks at the Bodhi tree, and he's just incredibly grateful, yeah, for all the conditions that have led to this experience. But then there's also this sort of sense he's not sure as though whether he can communicate this teaching. So he eventually decides that he will have a go, and he goes back to the people he was practicing asceticism with, other fasters, and he gets into communication with them and say, look, I'm not the person you knew, you know, a few years ago. I'm different. There's something different about me. I have opened up to truth. And this is how you can do it. And just really, over a number of maybe days and weeks, try to just get into communication, just try to describe the profundity of the experience that had happened to him. And then one of them got it for themselves. Yeah? One of them broke through into enlightenment for themselves. And that was a very, very happy moment for the Buddha. Yeah, because he then realized that he could communicate. And in fact, this like symbol of like lotuses like coming out of the lotus pond, that first person who understood the teachings, you can see that as like the lotus who was nearly open. He just needed the final teaching in order to be able to move into enlightenment itself. But there are some people who are like down at the bottom of the lotus pond, and they need to do a lot of work on themselves before they're going to be receptive enough to hear the teaching. And there's all sorts of levels in between. Yeah? So that seems as though that's what he did. He just got into communication with people, and he talked about ethics, he talked about practicing meditation, he talked about, he did devotional practices, he lived a simple life in the forest. A group of disciples gathered around him. And there were some people, I think there's a nice story about him meeting the first person. He sort of, very straightforwardly tells him, you know, I'm the main man, I've gained enlightenment, this is it. I'm colloquialising just a little bit, as you can tell. And he just wasn't interested. He just walked away and had nothing to do with the Buddha. So for some people, there was a charisma about the Buddha and his teachings, which they really responded to. And that also helped them to gain enlightenment for themselves. But it didn't work with everybody. So the people who were receptive, he taught. The people who didn't, who weren't receptive, they went on and carried on going about their business in their usual way.
Also, just one attention on the lotus. It's very interesting. I've been in the British Museum 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And you can see the lotus with the forearms. If you go to the ancient Egypt, there are all sorts of symbols about the lotus, symbolizing enlightenment, and then smelling the lotus is growing in a pond, that the flora will be going to afterlife. So it gave me the sense that this is a very universal, vibe about the enlightenment of the general.
Yeah, I think it can be thought of as a universal symbol as well.